Welcome to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's live streaming interview series, where leading New Thought teachers, speakers, and authors share the intimate stories behind the 10 best spiritual books that inspired them the most on their spiritual journey. From well-known classics to hidden gems you might never have heard of, the No BS Spiritual Book Club saves you time and money by sharing reliable recommendations from those who've walked the path before you. The No BS Spiritual Book Club, the only No BS guide to the best spiritual books to inspire your own journey of self-discovery. Here's your host, founder of the No BS Spiritual Book Club, Sandy Sedgebeer.
Hello and welcome. At the end of 2019, researcher, writer, publisher, and author Kingsley L. Dennis produced a video on how 2020 would unfold, saying it would continue a process that was unfolding across the globe, which was causing many to ask, is reality broken? The picture he laid out proved to be very accurate. Kingsley Dennis has produced numerous articles on social futures, technology, global affairs, consciousness studies, and consciousness evolution, as well as over 20 books, including Life in the Continuum, Hacking Reality, Healing the Wounded Mind, Breaking the Spell, New Consciousness for a New World, and the celebrated Dawn of the Akashic Age, with internationally acclaimed Hungarian philosopher of science, systems theorist, and author, Irvin Laszlo. Kingsley Dennis joins us now to share the 10 best spiritual books that inspired him the most on his life journey, and hopefully, with a little gentle nudge, his take on what we can look forward to in 2023. Kingsley, welcome.
Hello, Sandy. It's good to be here and happy to have this chance to talk books and stuff with you.
Books and stuff, yep. Love that. You said that you didn't come to appreciate books until your teens, but once you started, you were off. You were consuming them rapidly. What kinds of books did you start with?
Well, I started with novels, really. I remember one of the first novels was a D.H. Lawrence one. I think I started quite in the deep end. And I didn't read a lot until I was about, I think, maybe 13, 14, which I think was quite old, really, for me. And then when I hit 15, I just devoured books. And I got a kind of card for one of the bookshops so I could buy books and then pay at the end of the month everything I owed them. Quite dangerous, but it allowed me to really kind of ravish the books in the major bookshop. So I did that. So from really age 15 onwards, I jumped right in. And I didn't go through a stage of easy books, really. After D.H. Lawrence, I went into really non-fiction books. And I started from there and kept on since. In fact, only in the latter part of my life, I came back and started reading novels voraciously again. Yeah. But no, non-fiction for a great part of my life.
So at what point did you get an inkling that took you on this particular path? What was it that really sparked you off?
Well, in fact, I started writing before I started reading, in fact. And I don't know why that was. It was a natural impulse to write before it was a natural impulse to read. And so, in fact, I started writing poetry first. So when I was like 12 and 13, I was writing poetry before I was even reading poetry or reading any text. And I think because of my writing desire developed, I think something clicked and I thought, well, in that case, I should be reading more if I wish to write. So I think I felt I was a natural writer before I was a natural reader. And then, you know, finally the two streams came together and I felt I had some catching up to do on the reading side. So I think it was around 15 when I really started to read a lot.
A lot about the world, the universe, started asking questions.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I say I jumped into the heavy stuff first, which, as we'll talk about today, one of the first ones I jumped into was Gurdjieff, and not an easy start. I think I was pushed in the deep end by some universal force. I wasn't allowed a kind of 101 starting course or anything.
Mm. Yeah. Well, before we get to your books, I want to ask you, you said that reading books and texts is an art and a methodology. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think if you choose the right books, then they resonate with you, and they become part of your journey. They're like a diary. So if I go back and read a book, obviously the second reading or the third reading, every iteration gives you a further depth of understanding. And that measurement of depth of understanding is a measurement for myself. So the books are kind of like a scientific measuring board whereby I can see how far I've developed depending on how more I understand the book. So I don't read them as just like entertainment and put them down. I go back to them and they're like a diary. So instead of having to write down a diary entry, like I did this in this year, because I date stamp all my books. It's the only thing I do write in them, really. I write in the date that I acquired them. So when I go back, I can see where I was at that time and how the thinking or how my own perception has advanced. So in that sense, I think books for me have been like a methodology and a kind of mirror to myself. That's why I've always resonated with books that have been an impetus in my own cognitive awareness and expansion.
Your list comprises books that you describe as resonant, in that they brought a different texture, a different resonance to your life experience, and you've placed them in a chronological order, right? Of the order that you read them.
Thought for the benefit of our talk, they would help to also give a picture of my life journey by the type of material that resonated with me and how I went through them. In fact, just recently I shared the book list with a friend of mine, and their reply was, that looks like a hard list, like a hard working book list, not like a kind of, sit back on the couch and rest, but a kind of a working book list. And I think that's quite correct, because that's how these books came and how I chose them. There's so many more books I could have chosen, but I chose ones that I consider workbooks that were part of the working process, which is my own involvement. And so they are can be seen as a bit heavy duty in a way, but for a reason.
Did the process of having to whittle it down to 10 to kind of revisit those books, those times in your mind, did that do anything for you?
It gives me an urge to actually go through and read all the 10 books in one go again, because I've concentrated them into a certain path, a certain list. Maybe I should actually evaluate myself by reading all 10 books in one go. And also, when I went and had a look at, I flicked through a few pages of them again, and they're so fresh. And it's like, they exist in their own time. They're not dated, which I think is a good sign. I will go back to them, and they're kind of almost eternal, I think, these books. And also, I chose certain books which represented the corpus of an author, their range of books. So I could have chosen half a dozen books by one author, but that wouldn't have really been indicative of the books in general.
So let's start with the first book on your list, which is In Search of the Miraculous, Fragments of an Unknown Teaching by P.D. Uspensky. Mm-hmm. And that was published in 1947.
Right. Yes. I'm not sure. I mean, there's some a kind of controversy about the date. Some think it was actually 1950. I think it was first published in 1950, because I have my copy here from 1957. And I actually like the title. The original title is Fragments from an Unknown Teacher. That's what Uspensky called it. And this is a classic of the Gurdjieffian work. And anyone who's familiar with Gurdjieff would know Fragments from Unknown Teaching. And his relationship with Gurdjieff was, Gurdjieff said, I will let you into my teaching circle on one condition, that you don't publish anything of my teaching while I'm alive. And that's why it was published, I think, in 1950, because I think Gurdjieff died in 1949. So the book existed, but for public consumption, it was not until Gurdjieff passed away. And really, there's nothing like Gurdjieff's work when it arrived on the Western scene. His law of octaves, his you know, the strength that he was saying that, you know, humankind is asleep. You have to wake up. Today it's a bit of a cliche, humankind is asleep. But the way Gurdjieff described it, and it's so accurate looking at human nature and so technical. I mean, the book is quite technical. All these law of hydrogens, the law of octaves, these cosmic universal laws. But, you know, there's still nothing quite like it. There's similar teachings now. And of course, after 70 years, it's amazing how much the fourth way work has infused so many other teachings. So we see it kind of permeating the atmosphere around the realm of inner development. But at the time, it was so fresh. And Uspensky's kind of portrayal of Gurdjieff is not only the teaching, but he traveled with Gurdjieff. He traveled through Russia. He traveled through the First World War, through the Russian Revolution. And reading that book really made me understand that actually, if you want to benefit from any kind of developmental path, it's work. You know, if anything comes through Gurdjieff's teachings, it's work. You really have to put the effort in, and it really comes through in the book. And I still haven't grasped the fullness of the book. But if anybody wants to get a grasp on Gurdjieff's perspective and Gurdjieff's teachings, you have to look at Uspensky. I picked up Gurdjieff's book first, the trilogy of Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. I started reading and I thought, I don't understand a word of this. You know, and I was about 17 at the time. And so I investigated and I realized that there was this book by Uspensky that explained the work. And so I picked it up and I just devoured it. And the first time I read it, I realized that I didn't understand maybe a fifth of the book. So, you know, it's a kind of book that you keep coming to because Gurdjieff is so expansive, you never understand everything. And I think Uspensky it's amazing, I think, what Uspensky was able to do to put a picture of Gurdjieff's work, and no one's come close to that. There's been a lot more, you know, and that I could mention. I will mention J.G. Bennett soon. But I think really, Uspensky's work is momentous. And coming out at 1950, it was, I think, the start of the whole burst of 1950s onwards, cognitive, perceptive, transcendental development.
So what attracted you to Gurdjieff's work at such a young age?
Coincidence, because this bookshop I mentioned, I would go in there and I'd look over I don't know what the label was, whether it was esoteric section or spiritual section. I'd look over some titles and I kept seeing the spine of this thick trilogy, Beelzebub's Tales to His Grandson. I thought, that's an unusual title. I picked it up, looked at it. I loved the cover. It was a kind of Armenian looking cover, the tapestry. It was an Arcana edition, hardback. And I put it back. And then every time I pick it up and think, there's something unusual about this book. I flipped it open, don't understand it. And then one day I thought, if I'm going to keep picking that book up and looking at it, I'm going to have to buy it and be more serious about looking at it. So I just bought it by some curiosity. And when I bought it, I realized I couldn't understand it. So I had to find a pathway into understanding the book. And that came through Uspensky, and the following books, I think, in this list, all kind of followed on from that in some kind of tangible way, which almost like being nudged down a pathway of one book leads to another. And even though it may not seem like it does, when you read into it, you realize, aha, there's a connection.
So I think
I was being kind of nudged into a following a kind of thread through the labyrinth, Ariadne's thread.
Yeah, something must have happened, because that's quite a commitment to make at such a young age.
Yeah, I went to university at 18 years old and I took this Gurdjieff's book with me, and I endeavoured to read it in the evenings, and But I knew something was there. When I read the pages, something hit me and I said, there's something very powerful in this book. I just don't have a key to it. Yeah. But, you know, I felt it. If I didn't feel anything, I would have probably left it. But when you feel there's something there that you need to dig away at, then that's like for you to accomplish. And I had to accomplish some way into the Gajiv work. And Uspensky, not only me, but I think thousands of other people have helped to open that doorway, a small crack.
So the second book is The People of the Secret by Ernest Scott. And that was published in 1983. So if this is a chronological list, there was quite a gap between the first one and the second one on your list.
Well, not in my years, in publication, yes. But in my years, I came across, again, I've had the books here. So this book is quite unusual. It's not very well known. It has an introduction by Colin Wilson, who's quite well known.
Yeah.
And he makes this interesting comment by saying that if the author of this book, Ernest Scott, had been alive a couple of centuries before, he would have been burned for heresy.
Yeah.
Now, this book is a book that I keep going back to, and every time I read it, there's just something there which I missed previously. There's just so many details. And this is a book which starts, I think, what I call the books of the big picture view. And I mean, even I think the first two chapters, the hidden tradition and a secret directorate, I think are worth the price of the book alone, the first two chapters. And the bigger picture says that, let's say the development of human civilization across the earth is like an organism, like the body. And it goes through stages of growth and stages of pauses and stages of decline. And there's like a hidden tradition of wisdom, the kind of golden thread of the wisdom stream that goes through all these civilizations in some way or form, even the civilizations before the Ice Age. And it just hints at that. And it says after the Ice Age, there was a kind of rise of civilization. And in the last 1,000 years, i.e. from, you know, the millennium previous to our millennium now, there was a project by, let's say, a higher intelligence to raise the level of intelligence on this planet within humanity to a specific degree whereby it will be prepared to activate new organs of perception, ready for the next stage of humanity's development. In order to do that, you had to seed various cultures and streams within different civilizations. And the book mentions various, it mentions the major traditions of Christianity and Islam and Judaism. And then it mentions various, what it calls vehicles, such as the Jewish Kabbalah, the Tarot, the Troubadours, the Round Tables, Alchemy, Freemasons, Sufis, Initiatory Societies. And it looks at all these as seedings of wisdom to help the organism grow at various times in various parts across the planet. And interestingly, it says that sometimes you get a pause where you need to retract the wisdom stream and store it to when humanity is then prepared again to receive it. One example was the Dark Ages, and it says the monasteries and certain orders of the monasteries had contact with the stream of wisdom. And they agreed to create these monastery cultures where they would keep the wisdom, they would guard and protect it and even copy it in scrolls. And then when humanity had passed this dark age of stagnation, it would then release the knowledge back into the organism again. And it's the ideas there are huge in a way. And it treats the human organism as needing certain stages of preparation according to the time, the place, and the people. And so, I mean, I don't know really who Ernest Scott is, but whoever wrote it, you can tell had contact with some knowledge, because there's ideas in there which are quite profound, and the way they describe them are not always found elsewhere.
There are no clues to how he came by that knowledge?
No, it's not said. It's not said. So you could say, well, maybe it's speculative, or it's just one person's opinion. And I think you have to read it yourself. My own personal opinion is that I've read that several times, and based on my own understanding, I would say the author had to have understanding, because there's things in there which only resonate with a certain capacity of knowledge, let's say. So I think it's a gem of a book, really. And it's not like a very well-known one, but the knowledge in there and the detail of so many different kind of, let's say, projections in different groupings. They talk about the assassins, they talk about Freemasonry and different elements in different cultures which were seeding ideas at different times. And there's a lot of references in there. You could use the references of the whole library of bibliography.
Wow, sounds like an interesting one.
So I it's one of my favorites, and you know, keeps me on my toes by going back and think I missed that bit of detail. So was I not ready for it, or was I too eager to read on?
So book number three is The Masters of Wisdom, an esoteric history of the spiritual unfolding of life on this planet by J.G. Bennett. And this was published in 2018 by the J.G. Bennett Foundation. And I understand that it was distilled from a six-week lecture course given in March and April of 1954 in an effort to attract new students to his work.
Well, J.G. Bennett has been his estate has been republished in his books. It was first published in 1977, and I have a 1995 edition here. And I read The People of the Secret again in 1995, and J.G. Bennett was referenced in the first chapter about this huge vista of understanding of light, unfoldment of intelligence on this planet.
So who was he?
J.G. Bennett.
Yeah.
J.G. Bennett, actually, he was a teacher in his own right, but also he was for some time a student of Gurdjieff.
Ah, okay.
And also Uspensky. And in fact, J.G. Bennett at the time worked for the British Army, and he was posted in Istanbul because he spoke Turkish fluently. And the British Army was told that there was a strange figure in Turkey called Gurdjieff. And he has so many contacts across the Middle East that they thought he may be a spy. So they asked Bennett to spy on Gurdjieff, who was, they thought, a spy. And when Bennett came in contact with him, he first met him at the palace of a Turkish prince. And when he met Gurdjieff, again, he said, this guy is so extraordinary. There's something about him. So he created a liaison with Gurdjieff. And he was with him for a few years, and then they split off in different ways. And Bennett went with Uspensky, because Bennett was based in the UK, where Uspensky was in London. So for many years, he was with Uspensky, and he kept in contact with Gurdjieff. And then when Uspensky died in 47, Bennett went over to Paris to be with Gurdjieff and spent the last few years very closely with Gurdjieff. But he is an independent kind of teacher. So afterwards, he was never a kind of, you know, a mold follower of Gurdjieff. He would take Gurdjieff's ideas and kind of put it into his own understanding and other elements. So he's not accepted as a kind of Gurdjieffian teacher, but he was in some way working with the fourth way. So interestingly, this connects me with Gurdjieff, Uspensky, and with the book of People of the Secret. And again, this is what I call the big picture book, because it starts with this idea that there's this intelligence that oversees evolutionary growth on this planet, and that there are groups of people who are able to make contact with this stream of consciousness beyond the normal realm of human capacity. And they help to seed in these ideas and work as emissaries across the planet. So Bennett starts with looking at the idea of this great intelligence seeding kind of creative growth across the planet. He calls a kind of demiurge. And then he looks at groups who may be emissaries for this higher intelligence. And he focuses on one group called the Kwagajan, which were known as the Masters over in Asia. And these were a group which developed, were very powerful, very present in Asia before the Mongol invasions, and helped to kind of be advisors for rulers, and also worked amongst the people as well. They were in all sectors of society, and they helped to spread. These were before really the Asian wisdom streams were kind of known. These were just people who lived amongst the people, but they were known as the Masters or the Kwagajan. And then Bennett goes on to look at, after the Kwagajan, and that came the time of Christ, and how Christ was an emissary for what he calls the kind of the impulse of love. And the impulse of love was another seeded energy into the intelligence of humanity to prepare it for the next 1,000 years of development. And so he has a chapter called A 1,000 Years of Love. So really this spans kind of intelligence coming onto the planet, and then certain groupings around Central Asia, and then of course in the Middle East with Christ, and then over all the way through the Mongol invasion before that, and gives a kind of map to how we could see it exactly as the subtitle says, an esoteric history of the spiritual unfolding of life on this planet. So for me, this was useful in my earlier days to get a grasp of the bigger picture. And that stayed with me throughout my life, because I always now tend to look at the bigger picture of events and how they may influence and seed into the more micro events of life on this planet. So I tend to see, you know, from above and how they come down onto the micro life. And that stayed with me from these early days of always kind of taking the spotlight back and seeing the more origin of how things may be present before we see them manifesting now. And I think one of the things you have to understand is that when things actualize, manifest in our present or in our immediate cultural life or in our societies, they actualize because they've been seeded before. It takes time to actualize certain streams of wisdom on this planet. And that's these books, and like Bennett, has helped me to understand that process.
Wow. So book number 4 is another book about Gurdjieff, The Teachers of Gurdjieff. And that's by Raphael, two pronunciations, Lefort or Leffert. It's very hard to find accurate pronunciations on the internet. So I'll just leave that one. But tell us about this book, because it sounds really interesting.
It is. And again, it's not a major one or well-known one in the Gurdjieff corpus either. I would say Raphael Lefort, but tomato, take your pick. And I think what happened now, and again, this was around, first published in 1966. And now I'm getting into the books that took me down from the bigger picture into, I suppose, amongst the people, let's say, into the life. And this, for me, has several purposes. This is the one of the early covers. As you can see, there's a list of all the places they go through, this journey. And after Gurdjieff died, there was a kind of confusion, because there was no named replacement. I mean, Jean de Salzman is well known as being the person most known for following on the work, but it wasn't announced officially. So this book starts with this person wanting to go back in and trace Gurdjieff's kind of wanderings, because Gurdjieff had a book called Meetings with Remarkable Men, where he talked about going through the Middle East and Central Asia and having these experiences. So this person left, I think, London and wanted to retrace that. So you can see they go through all these places and meet people like the carpet weaver, the calligrapher, the coppersmiths, you know, a kind of like very kind of maybe cliche Asian kind of, you know, kind of people to meet in these artisan areas. Mm. But what unfolds is two things. One is that we're not sure if the people he met really did know Gurdjieff or really are part of the lineage, but the knowledge that they put out is quite unusual. You know, so this person really did meet people of knowledge, of wisdom, and that these people really were carpet weavers, calligraphers, and it makes you understand that there are people who operate on this planet who are there to transmit certain knowledge and wisdom, but they may not be known. Mm. They are diffused and permeated through life. And, you know, in the West, we could say they could work in a bank, they could work cleaning the street, you know, they could work being a plumber. Certain people take a role whereby their primary role of being transmitting wisdom or information and knowledge does not accord with their social role. And this person met these people, and the knowledge in this book I found quite staggering. A lot of really good information and knowledge. And also what it told was at the end of the book, when this person is trying to find the origin of Gurdjieff's lineage, and he did find people who knew of the lineage and talked about Gurdjieff, they then said, okay, you've had your fun, you've come over here, you've had your curious moments, we've given you a bit of knowledge to kind of help you on your way, now get back. And they said, get back, because the knowledge you seek exists exactly where you are, in England, in the West. So in the 60s, I think this was a kind of message by saying to all those people who wanted to jump on the hippie trail and go to India and ashrams, saying, well, at that time, the knowledge in the East existed because it was being infused in the East. But now, in contemporary times, the knowledge has arrived in the West also. And you need to find the knowledge in the guise, in the context, in the dress of your culture. Don't seek it in a foreign dress. Go back and seek it in your context, because knowledge is fluid and knowledge adapts itself to be transmitted according to, again, the time and the place of your culture. And so when this person came back, they did find a contact with the stream of knowledge, and it was literally just down the road where they were living, I think down in London. So the message there's a message of look in your own context and find something which is relevant to you. Don't put on the garbs of a Eastern wanderer and go and look up in exotic places. So that's a message as well as the information in the book, which I found, which I think was very pertinent.
So number five, Among the Dervishes by O.M. Burke. Now, I have that down as 1973, but what I'm learning is most of the dates that I've got are not the correct dates.
Well, in this one, I think it was 1973, in fact.
Oh, okay, that's the first one that's correct. Yeah.
And I have a 1975 edition.
I love those old covers. You know, the designs, the lettering.
I always smell books. It's one of the few things I smell, but books, yes. And this and The Teachers of Gurdjieff go together because they have a similar type of resonance and teaching, is that this person also, as a Westerner, goes into the East and to the Central Asia and looks specifically for kind of Sufic teachings. And they also find that when they go to these areas around the Central Asia, the teachings they find are extremely modern. And it's not, again, not kind of groups dressed in certain dresses and doing certain rituals. the information and the knowledge is very, very contemporary. And so it shows you how we can make a distinction between knowledge which has remained static. Sometimes when wisdom originates as a kinetic stream, but then when it reaches a kind of structure, whether it's a type of religion or a type of spiritual transmission even, if it stays within that structure, it slowly starts to crystallize. And what the author was saying in this book is that wisdom has to stay kinetic, because anything which comes into this planet from beyond, this planet has a certain kind of texture, has a certain kind of energy, which over time crystallizes things. And so if some knowledge or wisdom stays in the same structure, it too crystallizes, and it doesn't progress. So the wisdom you get is the wisdom from before, and it may not be totally pertinent to the time now. And so you have to look for bodies and groupings or communities or teachers who are able to take the transmission and then to know how to transmit it in the mode and the culture of the present time. And that's what this book taught me, again, is that they meet people in Turkey and elsewhere. And in one place, they meet a teacher or of wisdom. And one of them, again, was a bank manager. And one of them was a colonel in the Turkish army. And these people say, well, you know, my contemporaries don't know what I do, because we have to adapt ourselves to the culture and the times. But the wisdom that we're offering has this lineage that goes back for so long. And again, a similar message was that, okay, you've understood that knowledge is true, genuine knowledge is kinetic, and it exists, but this place is not for you because it's not your culture. Don't jump outside of your culture. You have to receive knowledge in your own culture, because that's how you kind of match with it. You resonate with it. So again, a similar message that O.M. Burke came back to the West with this knowledge and wisdom, but he had to find a connect with the stream of it in his own context and his own culture. And these people were saying, don't worry, you know, this stream exists, and it exists in your own culture. Just because it was more visible here and more exotic, you know, we don't want you spiritual tourists coming here. If you're really serious, you'll find it in ways that you don't expect.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So many people do think that in order to get something, they've got to work hard and go a long way, you know, and go on a quest for it when it's in the backyard often.
Often, yeah. It comes in a way that we don't expect, because we're looking for it through a kind of conditioned lens.
Yeah.
And we've been conditioned to say this is how wisdom arrives, especially when it was coming through an Eastern kind of modality. There's a Western stream through Hermeticism also, but I didn't come through the Hermetic Western stream. So I came into it through this stream, but then, you know, I was taught through this information by saying, it's, you know, it's already where you are, it exists where you are. So this is having to put you in your own context.
Yeah. So we're going to take a short break now. We'll be back in a few moments with more of Kingsley L. Dennis's 10 Best List of Spiritual Books. Stay tuned.
Om Times TV.
Maya Angelou once said that there is no greater agony than bearing an untold story inside you. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer. And when I'm not hosting Om Times Media's flagship radio show, What Is Going On, and the No BS Spiritual Book Club, I help people share their untold stories. Books are my life, my joy, and my passion. And there is no greater reward than helping aspiring writers get their books out of their heads and into the hands of those who are waiting to read them. If you feel that you have a book in you, but don't know where to begin, visit sedgbeer.com. Click on the Work With Me tab, and find out how my experience helping others tell their stories might be just what you've been looking for. That's sedgbeer.com, S-E-D-G-B-E-E-R.com.
Imagine becoming a super influencer. Reinvent yourself, invest in your brand, and then manifest your success with a robust spheric approach. OWN Times Media and Broadcasting offers a unique and multifaceted way to become the spiritual and conscious influencer you deserve to be by putting your message across our powerful platform with its proven record of integrity and excellence. Through our produced shows, OWN Times offers the opportunity to become a social media TV personality, a radio show host, an OWN Times Magazine columnist, and a syndicated podcaster, all in one shot. By live streaming your show on OWN Times TV and broadcasting it across the extensive OWN Times radio and TV networks, you become more than a host. You become an ambassador and a force for positive change. OWN Times. Open yourself to the possibilities.
There are 16 million children struggling with hunger in America. That's one in five daughters, sons, neighbors, and classmates who don't know where their next meal is coming from. Yet billions of pounds of good food go to waste every year. It's time we do something about it. Feeding America is a nationwide network of food banks that helps provide meals to millions of kids and families in need. Visit feedingamerica.org to help them feed even more. Together, we can solve hunger. Together, we're feeding America.
Welcome back. Kingsley L. Dennis. So book number six, The Commanding Self by Idris Shah. That one was published, according to my research, in 1994.
Yes, it was. And I have 1995 in my copy, so I just got it really when it came out. And I think this was a very powerful book when I read it. And I think I came across it because I was in the library, and the first time I read The Teachers of Gurdjieff, actually, before I bought my copy, my old copy, then there were some books next to it by Idris Shah. So I picked them up as well and started reading them. And then shortly afterwards, this book came out, The Commanding Self, which was a new one by Idris Shah. So I went and got it, and well, it was significant reading. And I think I chose this book because it was the first one that I really took to get into the Idris Shah corpus. But it represents the whole of Idris Shah's work. And Shah says that, you know, his whole range of books are like an oeuvre of teaching in itself. So, you know, you can work your way through it, and that is an organic type of teaching body. So I chose this book to represent it. And what I think significant about it is that it takes a lot of this wisdom or teaching, which we would maybe think has a Sufic origin, and perhaps it comes from the kind of Central Asia, but it puts everything into the context of psychology. So, you know, it can be seen as a spiritual book, or really it's a psychological book. It's a mixture of all of it. And I think what I noticed from this book and from Shah's books is that they had an organic effect upon me. That when I was reading them, I could sense that they were working through me and kind of changing me from within. They were changing my perceptive capacity and how I was able to perceive things and my perspective. And the more that I read of Shah, the more I understood. I found his books to be like a biological organism, if that makes sense, that I would ingest them and they would kind of work their way through my body, kind of like recalibrating my synapses and rewiring me from within. And so I can understand how Shah referred to his corpus of books as a kind of teaching, because they work on you. And he modernized, I think, he modernized the whole transmission of the Sufic stream for the Western culture. And this book is a mixture of stories, questions and answers, his writings and anecdotes, observations, and anything he got, he would put it into a Western kind of cultural lens. So it made sense. And the commanding self refers to like one's dominant ego, or the nafsi mara, as they would call it. And that we have to kind of dismantle that before we can really start to rebuild our perceptive capacities. And I think it was this book, Commanding Self, and the Shah work that first allowed me to understand that the real teachings first are deconditioning teachings, because we're so full of the programs of our culture through our education, our upbringing, all institutions, and each culture has different institutions, but they work to kind of program you according to the norms of the environment. And so we have too much baggage. And if you start any kind of path of evolvement with all that baggage, then you're building on top of like a false foundation, like building a house on sand, as the, you know, allegory goes. So what I found through Shah's work is that the preparatory step is one of deconditioning. And Shah's work did that in many books like Commanding Self. There's a trilogy of books called Learning How to Learn and Knowing How to Know. So, I mean, learning how to learn, don't you just learn? Knowing how to know. No, you have to know how to approach knowing, and you have to learn how to approach learning. And the first step is taking away all the kind of things that are piled on top of you. And I recognize now that these body of books and this work are great deconditioning tools psychologically for our cultural times. And I find them extremely useful. They are practical books as well as books for what we call evolvement or inner development. So, I would go back to any of Shah's books and open it in any page, and they would get something that I wouldn't have got previously. They're just, they're a living library, I would say. So really that book introduced me to that kind of stream, which really helped me enormously. I took it with me on my travels when I was about 23, 24 when I started working overseas for the first time, and I took them with me, and they were part of my 20s to 30 decade kind of companion.
We're going to move on to book 7. We will have to speed it up a little because we do want to be able to talk some more after your list is over. Number 7 is The Walled Garden of Truth by Hakim Sanai. And I think the date I got for that one is 11:31. Who's really around to tell us whether that's true or not? And he was a not very well known Persian poet who lived in the 12th century.
Yeah, my copy comes from 1974, but yes, it's 11th and 12th century. And I was in two minds whether to choose Hakim Sinai or Rumi, because I read Rumi widely. And Rumi is so well known, and I'm sure that Rumi books have appeared on your book list before.
Oh, so, over and over. Yeah. So it's good to have a different one.
And this one would actually hit me over the head, literally and metaphorically. Because Shah made reference of this work, that's why I came to this book. And it's poetry, and I want to include at least one book of poetry. But this really, imagine Hakim Sinai is not very well known, and not very well known during his time. He was kind of controversial figure. But you know, when you read it, it almost sounds a bit like Gurdjieff. And here's one extract. He says, all mankind is asleep, living in a desolate world. The desire to transcend this is mere habit and custom, not religion. It's idle fairy tale. Stop bragging in the presence of the men of the path. Better consume yourself like burning chaff. If you yourself are upside down in reality, then your wisdom and faith are bound to be topsy-turvy. Stop weaving a net about yourself. burst like a lion from the cage. I mean, it's really direct. It's saying, like, don't take yourself, don't praise yourself too highly, because you have to do the work first. Yeah. You really got to kind of pull yourself up by the bootstraps. And it's really succinct poetry, but a teaching in the poetry that just hits you. It hit me really, straight on. And here's a quote that I always liked. He said, "If you are impeded by your own inspiration, make of it of a stick to beat yourself with. Talk less rubbish. Keep your faults in view and leave the bone to the dogs." It's like you have to start making the distinction between what is the bone to the dogs and what is really useful for you. Yeah. And if you are, if you are in this world of nicey, kind of fantasy or fairy tales or this fluffy inspiration, the best thing you can do is take it, make it into a stick and beat yourself with it. It's really kind of telling you to buck up your ideas, buddy.
Yeah.
So I think it's wonderful poetry, wonderful message. And it's so hard hitting that after reading that, you have to have some effect from it. And the effect is depending on where you are on the path, I think. So that, I've done that one quickly.
Very relevant, still very relevant, yeah. Book 8, The Mind Field, a personal essay by psychologist and teaching professor Robert Ornstein, 1996?
I believe so, because now we're getting quite contemporary. Yes, it is. Actually, first published in 1976.
Okay.
But republished in the 90s in 1996. Ornstein, I've read almost all his books, I think. And now in the stage of my own development, I'm getting very deep into consciousness research. I've done the kind of Eastern path and that area, and I've gone through Rumi, and I've gone through the psychology or the Sufic psychology, and now I'm getting to kind of modern day consciousness. And there's a lot of, we're up to date now in understanding the left and right brain distinctions. And, more recently with Ian McGilchrist, he's talked a lot about the left and right, the pathways of the brain. But Robert Ornstein was a psychologist and also into the neuropsychology. And he was a university professor at the time and a practicing also. So in the 70s, he was one of the first, in my understanding, to really talk about the left-right distinctions in not just in the brain, but not just in a kind of technical sense, but also in how information and knowledge is utilized by different aspects of the brain. And in the mind field, again, mind field I chose as one which is a great introduction, not a heavy read, but it represents his whole corpus of books, the psychology of consciousness, the psychology of meditation, new mind, new world. And he also takes some kind of wisdom stories or stories from the East and analyzes them from an understanding of how they operate upon the brain's functions. And for me, he was the first person to actually kind of dissect how certain teaching stories were used in antiquity because they impacted mechanisms of the mind and helped to bridge the left and right mind to create a kind of holistic or whole perceptive capacity. And I think he was quite forward thinking at the time in the 70s to start to approach that. And I think he worked with Penrose, who also a neuroscientist looking at different aspects of the brain. And so he was a practitioner, a doctor, a psychologist, and a person for me who was able to communicate these ideas in a very easy style for the lay person. And I think that really to have a dip into consciousness studies, Robert Ornstein has some invaluable work. So we can see how psychology and brain neurofunctions all have an impact on how knowledge is received and processed by the human body-mind apparatus. So, yeah, I think it's very useful work.
Number 9, Sri Aurobindo or The Adventure of Consciousness by Sat Prem, 1968. And it's, you said for you, it was an introduction to the life and work of Sri Aurobindo.
Yeah, again, I came to Aurobindo quite late. Obviously, it's at the end of my list, more or less. And this book is a again, like Uspensky was an introduction to Gurdjieff, I would say this book by Sat Prem is one of the best introductions to Aurobindo. Because Aurobindo can be quite hard to get into, because although he was an Indian sage and philosopher, you know, he had a Western upbringing. He had a very kind of intellectual stance. And so his yoga is called integral yoga, but it's not a yoga of physicality where you do positions and work on the body. His yoga is a kind of mental consciousness yoga. And also, I think this is a great book because it introduces Sat Prem, and Sat Prem was, although he was a student of Aurobindo, he was more so a student of the mother. And the mother was the spiritual companion of Aurobindo. And so there's a kind of triangle there. You have Aurobindo and the mother who work together in their great work of bringing down the supramental consciousness. And Sat Prem, slightly controversial figure in the Aurobindo world, but Sat Prem for me is one of the best commentators and weighs in to both to the mother especially, and then to understand Aurobindo, because he was a kind of rebel. He fought, he was in the French resistance. He was in the concentration camps of the Gestapo for about 2 years. I mean, he said he didn't want to do this work, but he was compelled to do it. So he had this way of understanding it from a kind of, you know, a kind of wanting to dissect it. And Aurobindo, for me, I think he's done some wonderful work. And whereas a lot of teachings say that we have to kind of, development means that the human consciousness has to go up to reach a higher consciousness or a kind of, you know, this kind of vertical visioning of consciousness. Aurobindo's work was saying, no, the human vessel needs to bring this advanced consciousness down, what he called the supramental consciousness, because we need to diffuse it through the material realm. We you know, and that's our role. So we need to develop ourselves to have the ability to meet it by having a capacity of receptivity, but then stay in the body of the earth so you can bring it into the body through the cells of the body and into the body of the earth itself. So again, I find it a very practical teaching. And Aurobindo also talked about what he called the hostile forces, is that whenever you do the work for the evolvement of humanity and the planet, you are bound to attract what he called the hostile forces who are trying to pull you off path. But he had a very sensible understanding of these hostile forces. And overall, he's a very sensible guy, I would say. So having a kind of east-west bridge of understanding the yoga of consciousness in a slightly kind of oriental setting, but the way that it's understood and the way that it's attached to the cellular body of the human being and the development of the energies of the body, which is his integral yoga, to prepare the body to receive finer energies, is a very practical, and the way he describes it, I would say, is a very kind of almost Western method in a way.
Well, we've just passed the hour mark, so we're going to have to cut the last one down. I don't know whether you consider this the best. It is the final one in a second trilogy that you feel was intentionally produced to coincide with the events of our current time. And it's called Own Your Truth by Caleb Seth Pearl, published in 2021. So can you condense this one right down, but tell us as much as we need to know in that short period?
I put it at the end of my list because chronologically, I've only come to it recently, i.e. 2020. So there were 6 books, 2 trilogies, the Revolution in Human Becoming trilogy, 3 books, and then Own Yourself trilogy, 3 books. This is the last one, so it represents all of them. And there were 6 books produced in 1 year, and that's all as I'm aware. When I read them, again, like the other books, that I found that there's a resonance of truth in there. So the author must be attached to some kind of stream. And there was a kind of, I felt there was a kind of attachment to the bigger picture also, but they were transmitted specifically for these times, especially in the last 2 years, to help us understand that we're going through these contestation of forces, and we're dealing with a contestation of resonance and frequency vibration, and also a kind of controlling apparatus at this time. And so to understand the bigger picture in the first trilogy and the second trilogy, to bring that down into ourselves and to work on ourselves in a very practical sense, to kind of gain a sense of inner grounding within these fluctuating times of resonance fluctuations. So I sense that they were transmitted specifically for this time, like a burst, and I found them very practical and useful.
Yeah, well, that's your 10 best. And talking of the last 2 years, I know viewers would be very interested to know how you came by your summary of what was going to happen in 2020, and also what you think is going to happen this year, which everyone is billing as a really transformative year.
Yeah. Well, in terms of 2020, how do I come across anything? I don't know. I mean, inspiration. We're all open to inspiration, and it's all down to how we interpret the inspiration. Mm. So in 2020, I just had the feeling that, like I said, this consensus reality is going to be broken down. It's going to be melting, consensus reality meltdown, as I referred to it, and that the narratives that we were belonging to, or which we attached to, were going to be dismantled. And so we're going to be in this period whereby there will be a kind of contestation to remodel narratives. The main narrative, which would be the dominant one, trying to again assert itself, but behind that, all our belief systems and all the structured institutions that we had trust in would melt away, and we'd have to, you know, find our own, like a ship being moored in the harbor, and the rope breaks and off you go, and you've got to find your way to kind of navigate yourself. And I felt that was happening around 2020. And I don't like to be writing those occasions, but it, obviously I think there was some relevance in what I said about this breakdown of narratives. And this year, well, I don't like to do specific predictions. I don't want to be kind of, you know, predictive programming, but I have said to a few friends that I think that this year would be both rocky and revealing.
Yeah.
And of course, rocky in the sense that what's already been in motion is going to be accelerated and speeded up. There's a sense that there's a kind of race to get through this time frame or window of opportunity by certain agendas to try to run ahead with these controlling narratives. And things are going to get rocky. But of course, I think it's like a vortex, is that when you get closer to the center of the vortex, things speed up quickly. Imagine like you have a bath water and you pull the plug. The water goes down through the bath plug, and then the last bit of water, you see it spinning around the plug hole before it goes out. And I think that's what's happening. We're getting closer to this kind of, you know, this pivotal time. So things are coming like spinning like a vortex. So they're going to get rocky. But the old institutions are going to get rocky. All the things that we've been, you know, clutching to, and you know, psychologically as well as physically, they're going to get rocky. And the revealing side is pushing up. And I think there's two sides of the revealing. There's the top-down revealing and the bottom-up organic revealing. From the top down, I mean that, again, these institutions that we placed our trust in, or the groups or people we placed our trust in, there's going to be more transparency. There's going to be some more washing your clothes in public. Things are going to come out which are going to be distasteful. And we're going to say, how did they get away with it? Or I never realized that things were like that, because there's an energy of transparency coming in. And I think when that water goes through the plug hole, it reveals itself at the last minute, and we're seeing those things. So I think there's going to be more revealing as this unfoldment or collapse is happening. But I think there's a more important revealing coming through, and that's the self-revelation. The revealing now is that we're not only being compelled to really make our choices and really put our priorities into place, but there's a kind of energy of a kind of, which is supportive of the human awareness. And so as these forces of collapse are kind of happening, there's another energy of ground, bottom up, a groundswell of awareness. And it's compelling us to face our faults, our shadows, face our false allegiances, our false beliefs maybe, or beliefs that were appropriate for a time, but no longer are appropriate now. They're going to be revealed to us. And at the same time, we'll be revealed to our capacities, our strengths, the abilities that we thought we never had, choices we never thought we could make, that are going to compel us to make changes and shifts in our lives. We're going to be revealed to ourselves. Some of it may be a bit uncomfortable to begin with, but if we accept it and work through it, I think there's a great revealing of our way forward coming through. But I think these two things are happening now. The rockiness and the down, top-down revealing, which is not going to be pleasant, and our self-revealing coming up, and we're going to have to deal with it in this year, especially, and further years, but it's going to be all coming out a lot in this year. So I would say something like that.
So one of your more recent books was Life in the Continuum. And you've got a new one coming out soon, which is called?
It's called The Inversion, How We Were Tricked into Perceiving a Reversed Reality. And this ties in, it's coming out, I think, in September. And it ties in with what we've been talking about here is that, you know, things have been topsy-turvy. And what we need to do is we understand that, you know, we've got so far away from the essential of everything, the essential of ourselves, the essential of our contact with the world and nature and spirit and source consciousness, that we're back to front. And this inversion has been in kind of dominant mode for so long. And we need to perceive the inversion to work our way through it. Because when you perceive something, it loses its power over you. And I think the book, The Inversion, talks about this and then talks about how we can, you know, move through it and try to right ourselves up. You know, if everyone's hanging upside down, who's going to be the first person to say, you know, I think we're the wrong way up. We have to start to kind of recalibrate that way. And so the inversion looks at different aspects of that in our society, in our culture, and looks quite deeply and quite specifically at some of the work of Rudolf Steiner and his work what I call the entropic forces. He talked about aromantic forces. I call them de-evolutionary forces. So the book is looking at how we can go through an inorganic, artificial kind of technological transhumanist path and how we need to write the inversion the right way up and go through an organic, human evolving path.
Well, we really don't have much time left. I would have liked to have talked about other things, but, you know, I did an interview with you a few months ago on what is going on, and people can learn a lot more about you and your books and your work from that interview. So it's available on Om Times, it's available on YouTube, it's out there, and on Spotify as well. Kingsley, one last question. Do you see yourself as having some kind of mission? Or have you given yourself some kind of mission? The work you're doing feels to me to be very important work.
I would slightly rephrase it and say I think I have a role.
A role.
A mission to me sounds... it wouldn't be a word I would use, but I understand what you're saying. And I don't want to think about that, because then I may have to then take a stick and beat my ego with it. So I have to keep myself in check. But I think maybe an imperative. Yeah. I think I have a role, and it keeps me going and going. And, you know, every time I say I'll do something, like, you know, I want to write a novel and, you know, something else. And I, I get this stick saying, no, you haven't finished this part yet. You've got to do this. So I feel I have a role, but I feel everybody has a role, and it can manifest in every type of way, in the smallest or largest ways. And it doesn't have to be a grand gesture. Just, you know, we just have to find our roles and be comfortable with it and play the game.
Yeah. Yeah. And share what we know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And share what we know and try and be as humble and compassionate and as civil and sincere as possible.
Yeah. That's a really good advice to end on. Kingsley Dennis, thank you for adding your 10 best list of spiritual books to the No BS Spiritual Book Club's library of recommendations. I love this ever-growing archive that we're creating with people like you, and I think it offers invaluable opportunities for people who are looking for material to guide them along their way. So thank you.
Thank you, Sandy. It's been a pleasure to talk books and stuff with you.
Okay, well, that's it for this week. For more information about Kingsley Dennis's work and books, visit his website, kingsleydennis2ns.com. That's it for this week. I'm Sandy Sedgbeer, and I'll be back at the same time next week with another episode of the No BS Spiritual Book Club's live interview series. Till then, it's goodbye from me. And thank you, Kingsley Dennis, again.